Che Guevara, the Argentinian doctor who fought for revolution.
When I was a young man, I saw poor people everywhere who did not have the power to change their lives. I couldn't help everyone, but I did help the people of Cuba. I became a revolutionary and fought for their right for a better life. I was born on the 14th of June, 1928, in a large city in Argentina called Rosario, and my parents named me Ernesto, like my father. I had two brothers and two sisters, all younger than me, and we had a happy, privileged childhood. My father's family were from an Irish background, and my mother's had originally been from Spain. My father was a civil engineer, a person who plans, designs, and builds roads, bridges, harbors, and public buildings. My mother's name was Celia, and she was busy looking after all of us. In 1933, when I was 4 years old, we moved to a place called Alta Gracia, also in Argentina. My parents taught me at home for 4 years until I started going to the local primary school. My father also taught me how to play chess, and I liked reading poetry. I loved all kinds of sport, but I suffered quite badly from asthma, a condition of the lungs that makes breathing difficult. And when I was only 2 years old, I nearly died in a particularly bad asthma attack. Although I was asthmatic all my life, I loved sport and didn't let my breathing problems stop me from playing rugby, football, and golf. I enjoyed swimming, too. But most of all, I loved cycling. Because I was often unwell, I spent a lot of time at home, and my parents encouraged me to read as much as I could. Despite our middle-class lifestyle, both of my parents had left-wing beliefs. From a young age, I had strong beliefs too, and I was interested in philosophy. In primary school, I was fascinated by the Spanish Civil War, which was coming to an end, and I wanted to know what was going to happen to the refugees from the war. In 1943, we moved to Cordoba, and I started my second year of high school. One of my best friends at school, Dita, was a member of the Argentine Communist Youth, and we discussed the works of Karl Marx and other left-wing writers and philosophers. In particular, I thought about the many people living near us who were in a state of extreme poverty, and I wondered what I could do to help them. I decided to become a doctor, and I worked hard at school, graduating in 1946. The next year, when my family moved to Buenos Aires, the capital of Argentina, I went with them, and in 1948, I enrolled at the medical school of the University of Buenos Aires. In 1950, when I was 22 years old, I wanted to discover more about my country and how people lived, and so I set out on a 4,500-kilometer journey to northern Argentina by bicycle. I had put a small motor on my bicycle, but even so, progress was slow. One of the places I visited, called San Francisco del Chañar, was near Córdoba. A friend of mine from Córdoba, Alberto Granando, was working at the pharmacy of the leper center in San Francisco del Chañar. And I wanted to see him. Leprosy was a terrible disease that damaged people's flesh and often made them look awful. People suffering from the disease, lepers, were usually sent to special centers away from the general population, as it was believed that leprosy was easily spread from person to person. People without specific medical knowledge were often afraid and usually disgusted by the disease and the people suffering from it. I was not. And when I arrived at the center, I started talking to patients, and I became more interested in every aspect of the disease. Before I set out on my trip, I decided to keep a diary and to write down everything that I saw and heard. I enjoyed taking notes, and writing in the diary became a habit that I continued on later trips. Later, my family turned my notes into a book, and in 1993, The Motorcycle Diaries was published. In 1951, I took a year off from my studies and spent 6 months working as a nurse on a huge ship belonging to the Argentine National Shipping Company that transported petrol. The ship stopped in various places in Brazil, Venezuela, and the island of Trinidad in the Caribbean before heading back to Argentina. Then, with my friend Alberto, I set off on a motorcycle tour of South America, visiting Ecuador, Colombia, Venezuela, Panama, and Peru. On this trip, Alberto started calling me Che, because in spoken Spanish, Che means friend or man, and apparently I used it all the time when I was speaking. The name stuck, and I was never called Ernesto again. In Peru, I spent time working at the San Pablo leper colony, and I was shocked by the conditions inside the colony and by the way the patients were treated. I was also shocked at the living conditions of the poor who did not have leprosy. In village after village and town after town, I saw severe poverty, with the poor unable to live in decent housing or to have enough food. There were few medical facilities, and disease was everywhere. Death rates among the poor were high, but all around I could see wealth. There was wealth in the fields, in the mines, and factories. So why were so many people poor? I came to the conclusion that poor people were being exploited by the rich. There was no other explanation. I knew that this situation had to change, or be changed by people like myself. I decided that when I qualified as a doctor, I would not look after patients who could afford the best doctors. I would look after those who would never have the money for even the most basic medical care. It was not my only dream. As we traveled from one country to the next, I had another vision, and that was for all the states in South America to become united. In 1953, I got my medical degree, and I qualified to be a doctor. If I hadn't had asthma, I would have had to do military service. But I was free, and I set off to find people I could help. I soon discovered that it was not going to be as easy as I had previously thought. My knowledge and skills were not enough. I needed to do more than say what was wrong with patients and give them advice. I needed drugs and surgical equipment, and that cost money, which was not available. So I became angry and disappointed. I went to many places, some of which I had visited during my previous trip. Bolivia, Peru, Ecuador, Panama, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, Honduras, El Salvador, finally going to Guatemala, where I stayed for a while. In Costa Rica, it had been clear where all the money was. In 1882, the Costa Rican government had gone into business with an American businessman called Keith, building the National Railroad. The government had been unable to pay its share of the costs and was in debt to the American. As part payment, the government gave Keith 3,200 square kilometers of land so that he could grow bananas to send back to the USA, and the United Fruit Company was created. Bananas were very popular in North America, and the company, which had a monopoly in Central and South America, was making huge profits. However, I saw that the money that was made in Costa Rica went back to the USA and was not used to pay local workers properly or give them decent living conditions. This made me furious, and I called the company Capitalist Octopuses, promising myself that I would not rest until I saw their destruction. For the first time, I considered that perhaps medicine was not the answer to the problems of poverty after all. Maybe soldiers and weapons were needed to physically fight against those in power. In Guatemala, however, it seemed that the government was more in control. The president, Jacobo Arbenz, reclaimed all uncultivated land, land where no crops were being grown, and gave it to local people so that they could start their own farms. The United Fruit Company was greatly affected by this, as they had lost 910 square kilometers of their land. United Fruit had considerable influence within the American government. For example, one of the shareholders was the U.S. Secretary of State. The U.S. government viewed Arbenz as being pro-communist and a threat to democracy. At that time, their anti-communist campaign was intense. They overlooked the fact that Arbenz had been elected in democratic elections, however, and a coup was planned to remove him from power. It lasted 8 days, and although Arbenz's army tried to fight back, his resignation was announced on the 26th of June, 1954. Almost all of the people in Arbenz's government were forced to leave the country in fear of their lives. I had fought and spoken out against the coup, and as a result, my life too was in danger. I managed to escape and went to live in Mexico City, where I worked at the General Hospital. In Guatemala, I had met a woman from Peru called Hilda Gadea Acosta, an economist and protest leader who was, like me, determined to help the poor. She had come with me to Mexico City, and in September 1955, we got married. The following year, Hilda gave birth to our daughter, Ilditza, little Hilda. Unfortunately, our feelings for each other did not last, and after 4 years, our marriage ended. The USA's military coup in Guatemala had convinced me that it was necessary to fight for the rights of the poor, who had neither a voice nor a direction. I could provide both of these, and I became a revolutionary. I needed to earn a living, so I gave some lectures on medicine, and I tried to use my skills as a doctor to help those in need, but my thoughts were more on politics. One day, I met Raul Castro, who introduced me to his brother, Fidel. Fidel Castro, a Cuban living in Mexico, was concerned about the social injustice in Cuba. As in many other places in the world, a small percentage of the population had all the power. These were the owners of the haciendas, the large farms that grew crops like sugar and tobacco, and they were rich. The rest of the people worked on the farms. There were laws that stated how much produce each hacienda could grow in a year. And this meant that there were often long periods of time when crops were not being grown. This was not a problem for the owners, who had more than enough money to live well until the next crop was harvested and sold. However, for the workers, who did not have money or property, this meant unemployment and suffering. Nearly half of them were illiterate. More than 65% lived without running water, and only 1 in 14 families had electricity. They lived in huts with earth floors, and only 4% ate meat regularly. They had almost no access to education or medical facilities. Even though there were 5 times as many workers as hacienda owners, there was no way the workers could change the situation. In 1952, Castro tried to win a seat in the government in the elections, which would give him the power to make changes in society. It was generally believed that his party, Ortodoxo, would win. But before the elections could take place, a general called Batista led a coup, resulting in him becoming a dictator. With the support of the military and the upper classes of Cuban society, Batista's government gained the support of the USA. The following year, Castro and the other members of the Ortodoxo party, approximately 126 people, organized a counter-coup, an attempt to reverse the first coup and regain power, which failed. Castro was sentenced to 15 years in prison. But in 1955, he was released and went to live in Mexico. Castro told me that he was planning a revolution to take control of Cuba. The 26th of July movement, he called it, and naturally I wanted to be involved. In the beginning, I offered my services as a doctor, but I soon became involved in military training. The first stage of our plan was to invade Cuba from an old boat called the Granma. And on the 25th of November, 1956, We arrived in Cuba. Unfortunately, Batista's army attacked us, and many of our soldiers were killed. Those of us who survived hid in the Sierra Maestra Mountains on the southeast coast of Cuba. I was promoted to commander, and for the next 2 years, we continued to fight. Now that I was second in command, I had to be tough with the soldiers. Those who tried to leave without permission, and those who turned out to be spies or committed other forms of treason, were shot, and people soon began to respect and fear me. On the 2nd of January 1959, I led our soldiers into the capital, Havana, and we took control from Batista. Now things were different, and it was a time of great excitement in Cuba. Instead of being revolutionaries, we were government ministers, and it was time to put our ideals into practice. I introduced new policies, particularly on health and education, providing free health care and schooling for all citizens of Cuba. My goal was for every Cuban to be able to read and write. My personal life was changing, too. I had fallen in love with a woman called Alida March, who had been with us in the mountains. On the 2nd of June, 1959, we got married, and over the years, we had 4 children. However, there was little time for a comfortable home life, as we had other work to do. We had enemies to deal with, and especially those that had been Batista's supporters. Some of the changes we were making were unpopular with them, and it was decided that those found guilty of war crimes or of being traitors would be executed. We were afraid that if we let them live, they might take justice into their own hands and try to rebel. One particular change was in the laws that dealt with ownership of land. Firstly, foreigners, non-Cubans, were not allowed to own property. Secondly, it was forbidden for any farm to be larger than 4 square kilometers. Any land over this limit was given to farm workers or became part of state-owned farms. These were large farms that offered secure employment for the workers. Much of the profit made from selling sugar, tobacco, coffee, and beef abroad was spent on building schools, hospitals, and housing. Very soon after our revolution had taken place, Fidel asked me to travel abroad and talk to other leaders. In 1960, the USA, in revenge for the 1,900 square kilometers of land that American companies had lost, had stopped trading with Cuba and no longer imported goods such as sugar. So we needed international support to survive. On the 17th of April, 1961, a group of 1,400 Cuban exiles, supported by the government of the USA, tried to gain power again in Cuba. They were not successful. The episode was later called the Bay of Pigs Invasion. Our victory strengthened our position, and we came to the attention of the Soviet Union. Meanwhile, I published my book, Guerrilla Warfare. By this time, I had also become finance minister, minister of industry, and the president of the National Bank. In 1962, we allowed the Soviet Union to place nuclear missiles in Cuba. Under the very real threat of nuclear war, President Kennedy and the USA persuaded the Soviets to remove the missiles. In 1964, I decided to leave Cuba. I spoke at the United Nations in New York and traveled to Europe, celebrating St. Patrick's Day in Ireland. After all, I did have Irish ancestors. And then the following year, I moved to Africa. I lived in the Congo, which was a poor country that was rich in valuable minerals, such as gold, copper, and diamonds. Once again, I saw local people being exploited, and I wondered if revolutionary action would be successful. Local leadership was not well organized, and after 7 months, we stopped fighting. My efforts had failed, and I was fortunate to escape. I went to Bolivia in 1966, and I tried to start another revolution there, changing my name to Adolfo Mena Gonzalez. The Bolivians, working in the mines and fields, had long been exploited, but to my surprise, they were not willing to fight for their rights. I had a small army of fighters, but the Bolivian government's army was supported by the USA, and after 11 months, I was caught. on the 9th of October, 1967, when I was 39 years old, I was executed with my men. Was it all worth it, you may ask? Could I have done more by being a doctor and not a fighter? Perhaps, but I felt that the poor deserved a better life, and that I had to fight to help them get it. I died fighting for my beliefs, and that was good enough for me.